Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And what a week. That's all I can say. What a week. As you'll soon hear, it's been an absolutely monster week for InfoSec news. Top of the list is the Cambridge Analytica scandal, of course. For those of you who haven't had time to catch up on this one, a former staffer from the data analytics firm has given some interviews in which he says the company scraped 50 million Facebook profiles and used that data to target voters with political messaging on behalf of Donald Trump's election campaign. 50 million profiles, 40 million of them were apparently Americans as well. Now, obviously, this has made people feel quite uncomfortable. Everyone is mad at Facebook and it's big news everywhere. Now, how effective Cambridge Analytica's techniques are, we just don't know, but 50 million profiles being scraped off Facebook is pretty big news in its own right. It might not be a breach in the typical sense, but that's hardly relevant. Facebook's share price is getting hammered and just bad news for them. It also looks like Facebook CISO Alex Stamos is on his way out due to events entirely unrelated to this. Also in this week's show, we've got Iranians trying to blow up Saudi Arabian chemical plants. We've got the Americans blaming Russia for attacks on its energy grid. We've got Kaspersky blowing live Special Operations Command, like JSOC SOCOM ops, against Al-Qaeda and the remnants of Islamic State, you know, and there's more. So as I say, what a week. There is no feature interview in this week's show. We're just going to have to go long on news. But this week's sponsor interview is absolutely fantastic. Really good stuff. It's with Haroon Mir, who is head honcho over at Thinks to Canary. And he's not here to talk about anything really related to products this week. Instead, we're going to talk about CISO stuff. He'll be thought-lording the absolute out of all of you this week. Haroon thinks breached organizations are getting off too lightly in the current InfoSec climate. Because people are scared to victim shame, maybe a little bit too scared. As you'll hear, he thinks there are no excuses for how some of these high-profile data breaches have occurred and says more CISOs should be prepared to die on the right hills to stop their companies engaging in straight-up suicidal behaviour. It's great for security to not be a roadblock and to be an enabler, but that doesn't mean signing off on whatever your higher-ups want to do. As usual, Haroon Mir of Thinks Canary making good points. But first up, we're going to get into the news. And Adam, holy sh**, what a week in the cybers. So many high impact stories this week. I've been at this quite a long time and I can't think of a week in which, you know, another week where this much stuff has actually happened. But of course, the number one story around the tech world and you might even say around the world at the moment is this Cambridge Analytica scandal.
So yeah, Cambridge Analytica, who rose to sort of public awareness in the end of the Trump campaign and many other political campaigns around the world. New York Times and The Guardian ran this story about how they had built the data set that they used to mine, American people's opinions about things in the lead up to the American elections. Apparently, they obtained 50 million people's worth of Facebook data through this paid survey thing they ran on Facebook and then used that to kind of scrape access to other people's accounts. And yeah, it really doesn't look very good. And that sort of kicked off a whole kerfuffle between Facebook and Cambridge Analytica and also a bunch of regulators and, privacy legislators and that kind of thing. And everything has rather blown up this week.
Yeah, it sure has. And, you know, there's been a lot of breathless coverage over this that doesn't actually talk about how this happened and what actually happened. So I thought it might be a good use of the show to actually talk through that. Essentially, the way they got this data is there was an academic researcher who'd constructed a personality test app. And they pushed that out to a bunch of people. And then someone involved with Cambridge Analytica came up and gave them $800,000 to push that to more people. And that went out to 200, they paid 270,000 people to do that. Now, they had an average of 185 friends each. And through this API access that Facebook had granted them, that meant they could pull the full profiles of 50 million people. Because 270,000 times 185, about 50 million. Now, I believe 40 million of them were Americans, and it included things like their likes and whatever. Now, the person who blew the whistle on this, and I think he's in a video produced by The Guardian, which is well and truly worth watching. This person said that the API access included things like you could get access to things like private messages. He's not sure if Cambridge Analytica actually obtained that information, but it was available through the API. I'm not sure if he's right on that, but that is alarming if that is the case. Now, of course, this all stems from concepts that we've spoken about on the show before, Adam, which is if you get access to someone's Facebook likes, you can very quickly determine what their political persuasion is. And we know that Cambridge Analytica, through sting videos that we'll get into in a minute, they're all about tapping into people's fears, subconscious fears, and really dropping down that well. And what they say they do is they use this type of research to create content that really stokes those fears, and they what they say they do is inject it into the internet bloodstream and allow people to find it. It's unbelievable stuff. And, you know, Facebook are sort of getting into a semantic argument about whether or not this was a breach. Whether you call it a breach or not doesn't really matter. The fact is that through their API, 50 million people's profiles wound up with these Cambridge Analytica people, and it's, it would be ridiculous to think that Cambridge Analytica is the only company to have performed this type of activity.
Well, yeah, I mean, that really, from a, you know, the point of view of the technical relationship with Facebook, is the thing that's interesting there, is that the API access that these apps have gives you access well beyond the individual person who had presumably consented to, you know, having their information scraped by this app when they were doing this questionnaire, doing this, you know, research thing, what they thought was a research thing, presumably for the, you know, all of the $3 or whatever it paid them. But they, whilst they consented to it, that the users spied it out from there didn't. And I mean, regardless of whether you're going to call it a data breach or you're going to call it something else, you know, authorized use of an API or whatever else.
Well, terms of service violation, because the API allowed this. I mean, you can't even call it API abuse. And what really just blows my mind is why Facebook would expose so much. I can understand why you'd expose a friends list in the case of like messaging applications and things like that, and even games applications. You want to invite a friend to play a game with you. Okay, that's fine, right? But their terms of service say this information isn't to be stored. But why are you coughing up likes? Why are you coughing up full profile information on the relevant user's friends? Like, it doesn't make any sense. This data is Facebook's entire business. Why would you let it bleed out? I mean, we should point out too that this API access has been changed. The nature of the API has been changed as of a few years ago. So,
yeah, I mean, you would expect Facebook to take tighter control. But then again, right, I mean, Facebook, you know, I guess, is a pretty freewheeling place, right? You don't necessarily know that decisions about, you know, the granularity of access control or what's allowed for a particular API or what, you know, sort of an API that's built to support, say, internal applications then gets repurposed for, you know, third party stuff. You know, it can, you can kind of get, imagine how the situation arose, but it also does not seem that they have dealt with it very well. Like, the fact that they knew about this, you know, a couple of years back really doesn't look good for them, because it is, as you say, their core business, and the trust of their user base is pretty important to them.
Well, their share price has copped an absolute beating, and that only accelerated when the New York Times broke a story saying that Alex Stamos is set to leave the company due to differences he's had with other executives about how they should handle disinformation. That dropped like a bomb yesterday.
Well, yeah, I mean, it really isn't, you know, I guess it's not exactly on message for them at the moment. They don't want to be seen that they were kind of flubbing it internally. And that's really what it looks like, right?
It sure does.
Probably they were, I guess.
Yeah. So, I mean, the story is as reported by the New York Times and a couple of other outlets. I mean, this is out there now, is that they basically disbanded Alex's group in December last year. And I think he wanted to get out of there, but they convinced him to stick around till August because otherwise it would, quote, look bad. Yeah, no, I think it kind of looks worse now. So, you know, that very, very, very bad look for Facebook. But apparently Alex's group has gone from 120 people to 3, and most of his team has been transitioned to being supervised by the product team, which just seems an insane way to do it. So what he appears to be doing now, according to Nicole Perloff of the New York Times, is that he is managing a small red team in San Francisco, working to transition his group over to others and sending tweets. That's apparently the sum total of his responsibility at Facebook at the moment, which, you know, knowing Alex a little bit, I can tell you I doubt he's particularly happy about the way things have worked out.
Well, yeah, right. I mean, like, it's, you know, I can't imagine he's super happy about it. And obviously, you know, having come from Yahoo, also didn't have a great security record, you know, I'm sure he's going to want to do something actually useful in his next role, because, yeah, this doesn't look too good. And I'm sure he must be super frustrated. I can't imagine, you know, I would be table flipping.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of people think that Alex left Yahoo because they were cooperating with the government in doing surveillance stuff. That's not my impression. The impression I get is that Alex left Yahoo because they were putting rootkits on his servers without telling him. You know, it's not so much the lawful intercept stuff. It was more the way they were doing it. That's just my opinion and my reading of the situation. But also, I remembered that last October, you know, this is like 2 months before his group apparently got just razored. You know, there was audio of him that leaked saying that they were running their network like a university campus where they really needed to run it like a defense contractor. Of course, he backpedaled the remarks after this became public, but you sort of get the impression that maybe he was a little bit alarmed by the internal state of things, and that might have been something that caused this to blow up. So I'm not sure that it's entirely about his difference of opinion with regard to disinformation or whether or not it's about internal security policies. But whatever it is, you know, Alex is on his way out and it's clearly not a happy separation. And I think really we've come to regard him, I think the industry has and the discipline has come to regard Alex as kind of our man on the inside. Do you know what I mean? Which is why this is playing out so awfully for Facebook when it at least comes to the opinions of security people.
Yeah, I mean, his keynote at Black Hat last year was particularly well received. And yeah, he comes across like someone who does actually understand what it is that he's doing, which, you know, for, you know, big Silicon Valley CISOs is maybe that's a rarity, eh? So yeah.
It's well, maybe that's the problem as well, is because he's going in there and telling these people what time of day it is. And, you know, Alex being an optimist and a highly energized individual, he's going into these places, telling them what they need to do, and they're not doing it. I mean, if I had to just come up with a cartoon-like reading, that's going to be it.
Yeah, and that I, you know, must be super, super frustrating, you know, telling people what to do and what needs to be done and then not being taken seriously, especially when it is something the scale of Facebook, who does have adversaries that make them, you know, in the same category as a defense contractor, right? That's absolutely not hyperbole, you know, so yeah, I mean, poor guy.
Yeah. Well, I'll be very surprised to see him take on a similar role. I think this will be, you know, like I think this is, I'd be surprised. Let's put it that way. Back on the Cambridge Analytica thing, Channel 4 in the UK actually did a hint. If you had any doubt about what sort of people these are, we're going to link through to it in this week's show notes, but Channel 4 in the UK did a hidden camera sting with the senior management of Cambridge Analytica. And the things they say start off bad and then get evil and then worse from there. I asked you, Adam, to give up some time out of your day because, you know, risky business is not your full-time job. But I did ask you to watch that video so that we could discuss it because, you know, my jaw hit the floor. What did you make of it?
Well, I mean, I guess it's exactly what you would expect, you know, slimy data mining.
It's what you'd expect from movie villains, not actual real people, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, even the guy's name was Alexander Nix, sounds like a movie villain. But yeah, no, you're right. Like it is. It's just kind of creepy, you know, cyberpunk dystopia, you know, ridiculous future sci-fi, except that it's real. And, you know, I guess I didn't realize quite how many other elections and things they've been involved with around the world. I mean, I think we talked about the elections in Kenya and, you know, kind of manipulation of those on the show, you know, at the time. I didn't realize that Cambridge Analytica were actually in there running the election campaigns. And he's in this particular video sting, like he actually specifically says, or not him, it was the one of the other executives, specifically says, you know, we ran both those campaigns in Kenya and we generated the content and we wrote the speeches. And, you know, it really, there's just no ifs or buts about it. And you don't know whether they're big upping themselves because they're trying to sell something.
Well, but of course, there's an element of that. But when they start talking about finding people's deep-seated unconscious or subconscious fears and concerns, then tapping into people's sense of alarm and tapping into their emotions, I mean, these are the most amoral people I can imagine. They are horrible.
Well, they are. And that's one of the things that I'm confused about in this story, right? I mean, it is the whistleblower guy who Chris Wiley, who was, I think, one of the original kind of technologists involved in the company. You know, it's kind of it appears to come across like kind of a left-wing, kind of a liberal sort of guy. Why would you put up with working for people like this?
Because the project was too tempting. The project was too tempting. That's the thing that comes across, is he was into it, you know, because, I mean, what a chance to do this stuff. And, yeah, look, it is worth noting that, yeah, he does seem like a sort of lefty hippie type, like digital hippie type. And he's working for a group of people who say their ultimate aim is to reshape conservative politics and pump out this horrible material. But they say, we don't do fake news. We just do, you know, a spin on the truth and get it out there. But their whole thing is about stoking division in society, like just horrible. And then, you know, for Facebook to be complicit in this in a way by just being so YOLO with their user data, it's just, look, how quaint, let's put it this way, how quaint were the days when we worried about Facebook trying to sell us shoes?
I know, right? Exactly. Like, it's that the idea that we'd be worried about that seems so naive when it's politics. I mean, a lot of these, I guess, are techniques that we expect in marketing, and we expect, you know, in advertising, we expect to become, you know, manipulated by slimy marketing weasels trying to sell us shoes. But politics, whether it's the illusion of democracy or, you know, an attempt at actual democracy, like actually going in there and doing this for those political purposes, for essentially just, you know, either money or because you've got, you know, political ideals, or, you know, in the case of the nerds, right, that you've signed up for that kind of, you know, Faustian, you know, Wernher von Braun esque thing where the technology and the project is more interesting than, you know, having slaves build your rockets, right? Or over, you know, electing Trump.
Once the rockets are up, who cares where they come down, says exactly. Wernher von Braun. Yes, indeed, indeed. I think there are shades of that in this for sure, but just wow, what a story. And you know what, Adam, this was not the only big story over the last week. As I say, it's just been a monster week. You and I spoke about a mysterious APT campaign that looked like it was targeting ICS infrastructure. And we know a little bit more about that thanks to the good people at the New York Times. And it looks like the payload of this malware was actually designed to cause a chemical plant in Saudi Arabia to explode. The only reason it didn't happen is because the crew that put this stuff together actually made a couple of mistakes.
Yeah. Now that's, you know, the fact that that's not the first lead story on the news is amazing in itself, but yeah, like, wow, that we've got to that point. I mean, obviously Stuxnet, you know, was one of the first things we saw that was trying to cause physical damage in the wild to control systems, but actually blowing up a chemical plant, that's pretty serious business. But on the one hand, I guess it goes to show how complicated these plants are, that they tried and failed through their own mistake. The downside is obviously they're going to learn from their mistakes. And, you know, the software and the processes and the network designs and all of the technological systems that make this possible are the same everywhere, right? If it can happen in Saudi, it can happen anywhere. And that's...
Well, I think the Iranians, who are likely behind this, would consider this a form of poetic justice, given that they were the first victims or first publicly named victims of ICS interference, which targeted their nuclear program. We actually spoke about this in the show previously. News around this broke back in January, and it's called the Trisus malware or Triton malware. And, you know, it targets Schneider Electric stuff. This is the one that we, and I remember when we spoke about it, we were saying there's buzz around this one and we're not quite sure why. I think this answers that question.
Yeah, because I remember we talked about it in January, and I think I said it was in the UK on the basis of some, you know, rather flimsy thing, and then we had to walk that back next week when it turned out that actually no one knew what was going on, but it did seem like a big deal. It was the one that was targeting the, like, safety interlock stuff that's meant to be, you know, like manual controls. It turns out actually you can drive them electronically, but yeah, this does seem to be that same story now mutated into a little bit more, detail, but everyone's still being really cagey about the exact specifics. I guess no one really wants to you know, have the details of this be laid bare for everybody quite yet. But,
well, I mean, I got to ask though, if this is something that you're talking about the will of a nation, you're talking about the will of Iran, you're talking about a tinderbox political environment over there, you've got to ask, how long is it going to be before they actually succeed?
Well, yeah, exactly, right? I mean, they do it once, you know, you learn a few lessons and then, you know, you're going to do it again. And defense is super, super hard. Like, eventually they're going to succeed. That's, yeah, you're right. I mean, that's the thing, right? That means it's going to happen.
Or you wonder if this was perhaps a deliberate mistake. There's that other possibility that this is about leverage and not actually about blowing stuff up. But, you know, that's speculation built on more speculation built on speculation.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, torching all the disks in the, not in the industrial area, like in the office area, like that's sending a message because there isn't really any real risk, but you're saying we can do it. This doesn't really seem, I mean, this is a little too close for...
It's a little too close and it's a little too stealthy, right? So yeah, I'm kind of with you on that one. Now look, staying with ICS stuff, and you know, this is again, another story that would have been a an amazing lead to the podcast any other week is the United States has blamed Russia for doing pretty deep recon on its critical infrastructure, power, you know, power networks and stuff. Apparently they've had Russian attackers all up in there, and that attribution has been made public now by DHS, which is huge news.
Yeah, I mean, this was the campaign back in 2016 that was targeting all sorts of energy infrastructure people, like the standard sort of phishing and then dropping malware and then moving onwards from there. And yeah, we did certainly talk about it at the time, but yeah, no one really knew who was doing it or what was going on. Seeing this now firmly attributed to Russia by the Americans, you know, is more of obviously a political thing than a technical thing. I mean, we understand that it's technically possible and there's lots of people that can do it. But yeah, seeing this actually firmly attributed to Russia, that does signal, I guess, a change in the way that this is being played out politically. You know, we just haven't seen it yet.
Well, and you wonder if they got executive sign off when they actually rolled out this attribution, because you know, like well, the US government is not exactly as one at the moment in terms of how to handle Russia. But you know, another thing that's interesting about this is I spoke to a very well placed source who says the nuclear power plant angle on this has been overhyped, because all nuclear power plants in the United States use high side, low side networks, data diodes, stuff like that. So they're like, if you think this means they were getting onto, you know, nuclear ICS, you're wrong. And as I say, it's a very well-placed source, so I'd take their word on that one.
Yeah, although the boss of the DHS cybersecurity guy, Rick Diggers, did tell reporters, we did not see them cross into the control networks in the general energy case rather than specifically the nuclear one. And I really wish that they wouldn't say that, because it really just kind of discredits, I don't know, it makes me not want to believe anything else they're saying, because having personally done it, I know how straightforward going across in the control systems networks is. Like, the idea that someone would own just the office networks and then not be able to get into ICS if they wanted to is ridiculous.
Well, and how hard is it? How hard is it when you've got like physical access to at least a portion of the network? And these networks are very large. So how hard is it to actually get physical access to it? In a nuclear facility, that might be difficult. In large coal-fired plants, probably not so much.
No, I mean, even if you've got enough access to information, just getting someone to social to plug a network port in where they're not supposed to. I mean, that's totally doable once you've got enough information to know what to plug where. I mean, air gaps are a flexible thing.
They are. But I guess what I'm getting at is that this is a risk that the US government, I'm reliably informed, this is a risk when it comes to nuclear that the US government treats with appropriate respect, Adam.
I certainly hope you're right.
Yeah, without naming anyone. Now, look, another just huge story. Like, I just can't believe this. It is, and I'm not even on holiday. It's amazing. It's like it's all come at once. Theresa May is threatening retaliation over Russia's alleged poisoning of this Sergei Skripal guy in the UK. And she went right to the dispatch box in Parliament and spoke about retaliation. And it's looking like that might take the form of, I can't believe I'm going to actually say these words, cyber retaliation.
Yeah, like, wow.
Matt Tate wrote a piece for Lawfare about this. I mean, the venue from which you send a message is a big part of the message. And for Theresa May to say that from the dispatch box in Parliament, I mean, holy crap.
Yeah, I mean, it really does. You're right. It totally sends a message. And I'm wondering where that message goes, right? I mean, this is the classic challenge of cyber is that we, the West, are more dependent on this stuff than other places. But everybody depends on computer stuff. And I don't know where does this go after this? I mean, the idea that, it's not like you can de-escalate in the same way that you might.
Well, it depends. If you make it hurt, then you might actually get the Russians pulling back a little bit, but you got to make it hurt. And the one thing where they keep winning is they've got the stomach to do stuff that other countries won't, right? Like most developed countries, modern democracies, they actually do adhere to the law. Now, I know a lot of listeners don't believe that, but, you know, when they break the law, it seems to be the exception to the rule. They don't go around bumping off people with nerve agents in Moscow, right? And they certainly don't do it in such a spectacularly public way. So in that way, Russia is kind of like the Kaiser Soze of the international order, because they're prepared to do things that the next person won't. So how do you make it hurt when they are just playing the hardest of hardball, right? And let's see what happens. Let's see if we start seeing very embarrassing material or evidence of wrongdoing pertaining to high-profile Russians and friends of Putin hitting the internet. Let's see.
Yeah, I mean, well, I guess we are going to wait and see. I mean, it is, it's a very weird time seeing this stuff, being talked about by a British Prime Minister as a you know, as a tool of international relations, like an overt tool of international relations. Like that's a pretty big deal.
Now, in what is some sad news for me, but apparently has others, disgustingly, I might add, jumping for joy, Adrian Lamo has died aged 37, and Brian Krebs has written up a really nice obit.
Yeah, he has. Some, you know, talks about some of his earlier relationship with Adrian Lamo, who's been around the hacking scene for a long time. Like, he was famously the homeless hacker who would, you know, hack people from photocopy shops back in the, you know, early 2000s when photocopy shops were a thing, and hacked into New York Times, a bunch of other, you know, other places over the years. And yeah, I mean, I guess a lot of people, you know, feel strongly about his role in the Chelsea Manning situation. He was the guy that turned in Chelsea Manning to the FBI. But yeah, I know he seems like, I know a lot of people felt, you know, felt that he was a snitch as a result of that. And that's where a lot of the bile has come from. But that's a pretty one dimensional characterization.
It sure is. And I mean, like all of those people, and this is the thing that really gets me, all of those people who are saying, oh, you know, we're glad the snitch is dead. What are your opinions of WikiLeaks now? Adrian was ahead of the curve in seeing where WikiLeaks could go, and he was alarmed that Chelsea Manning was leaking material, including informants' names, to someone outside of the US government who had no business having that material. Now, there was evidence of wrongdoing that was leaked, and that was good, right? But those military logs that he was leaking, and that was the justification Adrian gave to me in interviews we did about why he actually dropped a dime. He said there was other material that was going to put people's lives at risk. And I had spoken to him a number of times about all of this. Now, one thing people might not know is he really did not want bad things to happen to Chelsea Manning, and he did agonize over that decision. Adrian had drug problems. He had mental health problems. He was homeless, and he was in the middle of that situation with her, and everyone expected his decision-making to be flawless. So first of all, he wasn't in a great position to be making big decisions. And second of all, he stood by that decision. And I checked, and the last time I spoke to him was when it was announced that Chelsea was going to get out. And he was really, really, really happy about that. He was genuinely happy about that. He never wanted bad things to happen to Chelsea Manning. He just was weighing up the risk to innocent people's lives from these disclosures versus one person's liberty. And I don't think he made that decision lightly. And I mean, all these people calling him a snitch. I mean, who are you, Tony Soprano? Like, are you living your life by the underworld code? No, you're not. You just, I don't know. Sorry, it gets me a little bit frustrated because, okay, Adrian and I, we weren't close friends, but I knew him pretty well. We were internet friends for a number of years. We used to talk a lot. We used to share things. He was an interesting guy, and he was very misunderstood. And as you say, having him boiled down to this one-dimensional thing, oh, he's a snitch. Go get honestly.
Yeah, but I personally never knew the guy, but I always got the impression that decision with Chelsea Manning was one that he really thought through. And I mean, as you say, like, he had a bunch of other things that, you know, he had to deal with as well. And but I don't think, even if you were in, you know, a perfectly amazing place and all of your stuff was in order, that would still have been a decision that, you know, you wouldn't want to make lightly or, you know, in a cavalier manner. And I didn't get the impression that he did.
I will miss talking to him. He was a very complicated individual, extremely smart, made thoughtful decisions that you may or may not agree with, but he is not what people think he was. Let's just put it that way. Now, Adam, more huge news, because this is the huge news week. We spoke about this slingshot campaign, I think it was last week or the week before. Kaspersky did a write-up on a fairly interesting APT that was getting around. It turns out that APT crew, according to this report in CyberScoop, was actually Special Operations Command, the US Special Operations Command, and this implant was targeting Al-Qaeda operatives. And now Kaspersky's blown it wide open, which is probably not going to do him any favors when it comes to getting back in the good books with the United States.
Yeah, not so much, hey. This was what we talked about last week with the Microtix as an initial intrusion vector, and then would bootstrap on your box and was then a really nice full featured Windows Trojan that didn't crash your box and had signed drivers and did all the things that you would expect good quality nation state hacking tools to do. Clearly written by English speaking people, and then the story now that it came out of the JSOC Special Operations Command and was in use against Al Qaeda. Yeah. And that it was a live operation, that it wasn't a historical one. It was one that was actually ongoing. Yeah, that's, I mean, I guess the question is, did Kaspersky drop it on purpose to tweak the nose of the US government, which seems kind of, as you say, not exactly going to help their current problems. Were they given the information by somebody else?
Well, this is what I wonder, right? Who else would be poking around in those types of places? And who else would have those samples? Yeah. And would it be a nice way to bloody the nose of an adversary by passing on samples that they were using, you know, against Al-Qaeda? I mean, this is, you know, this is tinfoil hattery at its finest, but you got to ask that question, right? Whether or not some sort of Russian intelligence service actually passed it on to Kaspersky to say, here, you might want to have a look at this.
Yeah, specifically check for keyloggers right here because, you know, there might be one. Hint, hint.
Yeah.
It's... I don't know. Like, I'm not, the question is, like, do you imagine Kaspersky is complicit or is, you know, being duped and used as a tool of their own government in this case? We don't really know, right?
Or did they just find some interesting malware and write it up?
Exactly, right? Maybe it's just bad luck, right?
Yeah. But the fact that we're having this conversation is kind of proof that there's a bit of a cloud over them, I guess.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, at minimum, Kaspersky are really good at reverse engineering stuff and they're great at pulling apart this kind of thing. And it may be that other people have looked and just didn't have the necessary knowledge and skills to really pull it apart. And they do. Like, it might just be as simple as that. But, yeah, we don't know.
Yeah. Telegram has lost its appeal in the Russian courts over handing over its encryption keys to the Russian government. So that's interesting. So if you're using Telegram, you know, Boris and Sergey are likely reading your messages.
Yep, so maybe reconsider that if you are a target of the Russian state.
They're planning a further appeal to the Supreme Court, so that's interesting. This is interesting, right? Like last week we spoke about this Phantom Secure, you know, modified BlackBerry package and modified phone package, and the CEO got arrested and they were selling stuff to the Sinaloa cartel. Turns out their number one market was Australia and very popular with the biker gangs, which here are actually, you know, pretty deep in organized crime.
Yeah, I was going to say, you must have a lot of gangsters to be the number one market for this kind of thing. Something like 50% of the devices they sold were going into Australia. So, yeah, you guys are, you know, criminals, I guess.
Yeah, it seems, as I say, it's really popular with the bikers like Hells Angels, Rebels, you know, all of those types. And there's been a handful of really sort of high profile daytime murders involving those people lately. And these devices have been linked to it. Meanwhile, you know, the AFP, I think, has rolled up a whole bunch of the devices. And I think, you know, there's even been reports that the feds, I don't know which feds, got access to the servers and maybe they've been decoding messages and stuff. But anyway, yeah, bad stuff all around for users of Phantom Secure. Oh, just quickly, Adam, this is kind of an inevitable story, but people have been putting child exploitation material on the Bitcoin blockchain, which is just insane. But it also means that anyone who possesses the blockchain is now in possession of child exploitation material. So that's fun.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's a thing I guess people had speculated about happening before. We remember there were some stories, you know, a few years back of people putting like the iCar, you know, virus test string in it so that people's AV would trigger and delete their blockchains and all that kind of thing. But yeah, apparently some German researchers have actually identified actual child exploitation material in the blockchain, which will make possession of it a crime in a bunch of jurisdictions.
Including here and in your country and in the US and, you know.
Yeah, and ideally everywhere. It should probably be a crime in every jurisdiction. But yeah, I don't know what you're going to do about this, blockchain aficionados.
Well, I mean, that's cover, isn't it, for people who actually want to possess that material. I own Bitcoins, you know? I mean, you wonder why someone's doing this, but that could be one possible reason.
Well, I mean, I suspect probably it's trolling, but I mean,
Yeah, probably.
I mean, it doesn't seem like a really feasible way to store any quantity of material and would seem kind of expensive. But
well, it's barely feasible as a way to transfer value. So,
exactly right.
There's that. All right, Adam, look, we're going to wrap it up there for the week's news. There's a few more items in this week's show notes that people can read if they'd like to have a look. There's a bit of a write-up on Pwn2Own, a few other pieces, a few other items there. But we'll wrap it up there. Mate, it's been an absolute pleasure walking through all of this spectacular news with you, and I'll look forward to chatting to you again next week.
Yeah, hopefully next week will be a little bit quieter, eh? We can have an easy week. We can talk about some nerd stuff. It'll be great.
With a cup of tea and have a relaxed conversation.
Cup of tea, domain admin, it'll be great.
I'll look forward to it. That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Big thanks to him for that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Haroon Mia of Thinkst Canary. Thinks to Canary makes hardware and virtual honeypots that are wildly popular. You can check them out at canary.tools, and I recommend you do. Make no mistake, if you're in a defensive role, you should probably just buy a couple of canaries and put them in the parts of your network that keep you up at night. But yeah, as I said earlier, Haroon isn't here to talk about anything related to Canary today. He's here to talk about breaches and accountability. Some of you will remember that late last year, I had an ex-Anthem InfoSec staffer on the show to talk about how that breach went down. That was a 2015 breach affecting something like 79 million, tens of millions of records. Stephen Moore was the guy I interviewed for that, and he wasn't the chief security officer. He was on the detection team, but he walked through how that breach happened. In the end, while they were busy fending off one crew, a different APT crew came in and stole all of their stuff. The successful attack came in via the network of a recent acquisition. This new company had basically unfettered access to Anthem's data. Now, Haroon was listening to that interview, and frankly, it pissed him off a bit. He hates this idea that, oh, well, it was a recent acquisition and it was a business requirement that they be provisioned access to that data, and that's that. He says that because the breach happened in 2015, they should have at least caught it in the exfil stage. And here's the thing, Haroon doesn't believe in breach victim shaming either, but he says we can and should expect better of the companies InfoSec professionals work for. But anyway, here's Haroon Mir, and I started off by asking him what he thinks of Anthem's explanation that data was taken due to a partner's access to its database. And here's what he said.
Yeah, I certainly don't love it. And one of the things that scare me about that type of thinking is that it's the sort of thing that nobody wants to talk about because it almost feels like you're kicking someone who's down. And it's interesting because
People call it victim shaming, right?
Yeah, exactly. And Stephen actually mentioned it in his interview. He said, like, you know, we need to get rid of this victim shaming. And like personally, I don't think I've ever done victim shaming. Like, in fact, a few years ago, I did a talk at Troopers where I gave one of the good reasons why you shouldn't victim shame. Like one of the big things is people look at something post breach and they think it was a moment in time. Like, oh, how foolish, they didn't do X. And I likened it, as strange as it may sound, to War and Peace, because there's like a chapter in War and Peace where they say when you're an armchair general and you examine an old battle, it's easy to see, like, at this point, the general should have done X. But when the battle was going on, the general didn't see that as point X, right? He had, like, a train coming through and he had people who were rioting. So it always looks different with 2020 hindsight. But again, the very subtle thing that I have a problem with is that in our attempt to not victim shame, it's really easy to not A, take away the lessons we need to, and B, be really introspective in a way that matters. And when it comes to breaches like this, one of the things, so there's an old Dan Gear quote about most security folks just hoping that when the breach comes, it doesn't come on your watch. And I think that's totally true, right?
Most orgs walk to- I got to point out that, you know, the Risky Business logo is, you know, a revolver with a bullet, with a single bullet in it, right? So, I mean, that's the whole right. Gag. I very much understand what you're saying there.
While I'm totally okay with realizing that, you know, there but for the grace of God go I also think that we've had enough breaches now for people to start asking themselves realistic questions, right? So the first big name breach that happens, like, even if you were foolish enough to victim shame and laugh, the second thought in your head should have been, how would this play out against my org? Like how would we have reacted in situation X? And that's why I think, like, one of the things that prickled me with the Anthem interview was the whole thought that said, like, this took us by surprise. And I kind of feel like if you told me you were getting taken by surprise by APT owning you in 2005, which is already like a few years into InfoSec as a serious industry. But this breach happened in 2015. And in 2015, if you're a multi-billion dollar company and breach surprises you, then I think something's very wrong there. And like a way early talk I gave, again, this whole thing is just me pitching my early talks. Like I gave this talk called Fig Leaf Security, talking about all of the fig leaves that we end up hiding behind in InfoSec. And one of the big fig leaves is the board doesn't care. And there was certainly a time when companies didn't care and boards didn't care. But Black Hat's a bazillion people now. Like RSA is a bazillion people. And all of these orgs have multifaceted teams traveling the world, sitting on Aeron chairs. The boards think that they've done something. Like the boards are paying defenders to defend. It's just that the defenders might not know how yet and just haven't filtered that message back upstairs to say, holy smokes, like we absolutely don't know where we stand.
Look, it's interesting what you say. You've touched on a few things there. And one of them that I found interesting was this idea that, you know, these companies need to ask themselves the tough question. And I think they're the tough questions. And I think there are some organizations doing that. So after the Equifax breach, you know, we did an episode where we went after them pretty hard for that because, you know, they got owned by a really stupid bug in their primary, you know, in a framework right. that was being hosted on their primary infrastructure. But then a CISO who I know who works for a very large US organization that I assure you everyone has heard of got in touch with me right. and he's only been there a short time. And he said, look, that's what it is. That's what it looks like sure. inside an enterprise. And you know what? We can't fix it. I've got zero visibility into what's running where. All we're doing is trying to, you know, sort of sanely DevOps the new stuff, try to mitigate the risk on the old stuff as best we can and just wait for that technology to bleed out and die. So
I hear it and I buy it. And I think there are some organizations.
It's the technical debt is what I'm getting at, man. There's just, you know, sure, there's too sure. much of it.
And I totally buy it. And I think there are orgs where you take on ridiculous amounts of technical debt and you basically pray that that stuff doesn't get hit. Or you have your discussions with your board or your company to say, like, listen, this stuff's currently unprotectable. We've got no visibility into it. But having said that, I do think so. I'll branch to something completely, only mildly related. So right now everyone's talking about Google's BeyondCorp, and there's a little more fairy dust around it. So people are a little super hopeful about BeyondCorp, but the idea is solid, and I love it.
Yeah, I'm one of them. So I'm excited you said that. I'm reassured that you said that. I was waiting for you to lay into it then, but please continue.
No. So in fact, when I spoke at Black Hat a few years ago, like I did a hands up anyone who's heard of Mark Dowd's airdrop bypass attack, most of the room put up their hands, and then I go, hands up, how many of you have heard of BeyondCorp? And literally one person put up their hand, and I went, do you work at Google? And he said, yes. So I've been a fan of BeyondCorp for a while, but one of the things that I love about BeyondCorp, if you read the early papers, is how they implemented it in Google. Because like if you talk BeyondCorp to a regular company today, they'll tell you, well, it's fine for Google, but not for us because we've got all this legacy stuff. And if you read the original paper, you'll see that Google had a ton of legacy enterprise apps also. Mm. And they detail how they securely engineered around it. Like for some systems, they literally went, who knows what this is? Let's turn on a sniffer for a week. Let's see what happens when we flip this switch. Okay, looks like we can migrate this across that way. And that sort of thinking for me is super important because you move into a big org. If you week one and you've just taken over Equifax, absolutely, there's no way you can get a handle on all of it. But if you're 2 years in at Equifax, like normally they say you give a politician 100 days, but if you are N years in, even at an Equifax, at that point, you should know, here's the stuff that I know about, here's the stuff that I don't know about, and here's how I know that the stuff that I don't know about isn't going to bite me in other areas. In fact, it's interesting because when Stephen Moore spoke about the Anthem breach, he said something super interesting, and you actually picked up on it because he said, look, there was this connected subsidiary and we were doing well. And you asked him, like, so did the connected subsidiary have the data or did their position give them access to the data? And he said, no, it was the latter. So essentially, they connected these untrusted guys to their network, and then those guys had access to the data. And what should immediately prick your ears up there is it doesn't matter where the attack came from, right? Because at that point, what he's saying is they were counting on their perimeter protecting them, and they had let someone else into their perimeter prematurely. But actually, what we've been harping on for years is detection, containment, and response, right? So if you've got this core of data, like if you've got these 79 million records that are your core data, it shouldn't matter that the guy is accessing it from your CEO's table, from inside, or from a connected subsidiary. You should notice.
Well, and I see how you're tying this back to BeyondCorp, because that's, you know, that's really the thinking there. And I should point out too that you know, Duo Security, another Risky Business sponsor, is going all in on BeyondCorp and trying to make it something that regular enterprise can do. But I just want to pick up on something that you're saying there about this whole idea of like unexpected side channels. I mean, in that case, it should not have been unexpected. I'm with you on that. But it makes me think of this Facebook thing with Cambridge Analytica, right, where they basically leaked 50 million profiles through, and I don't even know if you could call it API abuse. It's more just like a terms of service violation, and it is sloppy. Yeah. They should have seen that potential for abuse. And when you think about how valuable that data is to Facebook, I mean, they're the crown jewels, and they were letting it bleed out through an API. So you can see these boneheaded decisions, can't you? In a lot of these cases where it's like you're getting owned because you gave people the wrong access to the data, basically.
Absolutely. So you can totally see it. And I'll tell you a big difference for me in how those two things have played out is, and granted, both these people are not speaking for the organizations, but if you take Alex Stamos's tweets since the incidents, and I believe he has erased some of them for clarity, but Alex looked at those tweets and went, look, this isn't a breach. And so there's questions about
And then we wind up in a semantic argument about what a breach is, which isn't helpful.
Yeah, but anyway. but what's super interesting for me is he went like, look, back then it was allowed, and we figured out that was bad, and we stopped allowing it. So essentially, to your point, he went, yes, we were allowing all this data to go without paying attention. We started paying attention. That stopped happening a while ago.
Yeah.
As opposed to the answer that we had on Anthem, which went, those 78 million records walked out of our door. Please be careful who you connect to your network, guys, because you can't trust everyone you connect to your network. And so my immediate thing is like, no, you're missing the point. It doesn't matter if you connect anyone to your network. You should notice when 80 million records start walking out in a way that you don't expect. Mm. And of course, part of
the discussion there. Yeah, I mean, you've got to engineer around that, don't you? You have to just, and that's like, back to the BeyondCorp thing. It's all about zero trust networks, right? Like,
And again, you won't get to BeyondCorp immediately, but these guys weren't stealing Anthem's maybe kind of interesting records. They were stealing their crown jewels. Like if you started off and had 100 days, detection around these records would be your first month. So again, and I don't mean to come out harsh against Anthem. I just think it's really instructional, and it's a good example, because in exactly those cases, like all of the stuff, and again, purely as a vendor, so you've got to take this for what it's worth. Like a lot of what they said was, look, guys are in your network, guys are moving laterally, you're not picking them up. Yes, that's why we exist.
That's because, your job, dude.
it's exactly that stuff. Because if you don't know when people are moving laterally on your network, then you don't know what matters. Mm. So I'm a little bit worried that in our quest to not be asses, which I maintain we should not be, we fail to take away important lessons. And I'm all for Team Blue. Like I've given enough talks recently or in the last few years saying, come play for Team Blue. There's lots of fun and lots of, but I'm also totally for standing up and saying, listen, we're sucking at this bit, and we're going to keep sucking at this bit unless we start being honest with ourselves and then fixing it.
Okay. So I want to just pivot off onto something else there, because we're running out of time, and I do want to cover this. for the last 15 years or so, and it came up in an interview recently, for the last 15 years or so ago, we've been talking about this concept of security as an enabler. You know, don't be the security people who say no. Be the people who find out how to do it and mitigate the risk. And, you know, that sounds great, but sometimes I do worry that security as an enabler is code for YOLO, basically, you know? That's what I worry about. And I see guys like, you know, your former colleague, Dan Cuthbert, who is now in a defensive role for a very large organization. You know, he's big on BeyondCorp. Just, you know, this is just from reading his tweets. And he's also big on the idea of security as an enabler. And do I trust Dan Cuthbert to, you know, be someone who can enable projects and deliver security around it? Yes, I do. But do I trust everyone to do that? Probably not. And that's, it's just that whole philosophical battle between being the people who say, no, you can't connect this acquisition to our database because we don't know what their network looks like or what their team looks like, versus, okay, we've got to do it because it's a business requirement. And picking, if you're going to pick a line as a security professional or as a security executive, you have to make that call, and it might mean dying on a hill. And I think this feels like kind of what you're talking about, which is more people need to die on hills.
Yeah, absolutely. So the listeners might not know, but like I pulled a stint as a CISO for a really short time for an embattled organization.
Yeah.
And one of
it would be funnier if you could actually mention who it was and what the circumstances were, but I know you can't. But anyway, let's continue. Yeah.
And so one of the things really early on was I went up to effectively to the chairman and said, like, listen, I'm going to do some things and some people are going to hate me, but you need to back my play for the next 2 months. And he said, cool, I'll back your play. And that gave me 2 months of cover. And then I did some things. And at every stage, you know, like, listen, like for this, you're making a leap because you're going to commit all your resources to defending X and not Y. And if Y got taken instead of X, my bad. Like that was my call. And that would have been a hill I would have had to die on. And yeah, it's I think you spot on right in the analysis that says the stuff's got to come with some consequences. Like you make those calls, you go for it, you die. What I want to stamp out, and it's super interesting because if you look at lots of these newfangled Silicon Valley companies, there's this whole pitch for blameless postmortems when something goes horribly wrong. So you don't get to whoop anyone anymore. You get to say, like, let's find the root cause of it. But I think people go too far when they think that blameless means a lack of accountability. And one of the things that I think we in defense have kind of lacked for a long time is accountability. I talk about it. So a little while back on your show, I actually spoke about the cool things that the guys were doing with crypto anchors at Square and the cool things that Ryan Huber was doing over at Slack, saying that security engineering actually works because it makes your security team accountable in a way that old-style security teams were not. And yeah, I think that's part of where we need to go for security to grow up.
So instead of people spitting out catchphrases like security is an enabler, they actually need to make some hard decisions and be prepared to face the consequences if it goes wrong.
Yeah, let's leave the trite comments and fancy Sun Tzu quotes for RSA where it belongs.
Okay, well, that's a bit rich coming from a guy who just quoted War and Peace in an interview, but I'll take it on board. Haroon Mir, thank you very much for joining us on the show. We've gone massively over time, but that's fine because that was all really, really interesting stuff. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Pat. Bye.
That was Haroon Mir of Thinks to Canary there with a great all-round chat about data breaches and accountability. Do check out Haroon's stuff at canary.tools and you will be glad you did. Thinks to Canaries fall into that no-brainer category as far as InfoSec spending is concerned. So do check them out. But that is it for this week's show. I do hope you enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.